During his Christmas address to the Roman Curia in his first year, Pope Benedict highlighted the now famous distinction between two hermeneutics for understanding the Second Vatican Council, one of discontinuity and rupture, and the other constituted a reform of renewal and continuity. On one level, Benedict was doing nothing other than to describe a church divided in her most recent council and showing that the Pope has it within his gift to show us unity, to be both the bridge and bulwark against schism. On another level, he was simply naming an epistemic aspect of a deeper crisis, indeed a storm brewing in the church of great historical consequence. The mediocre epigonies of the once powerful Bologna school continue to sell their wares. One experienced commentator treats the council not in continuity with all prior councils, but as a new constitutional event, which unleashed a new dynamic energy to help usher in a new age of Catholicism. Indeed. On the flip side of this rupture view stands Catholics who have separated themselves from full communion, full stop. They stand firmly with Trent and against Vatican II, just as another small but vocal minority stands for Vatican II and against Trent. In this way, left and right ironically unite in their epistemic rupture. It is a heavy burden they bear, whether they lean traditionalist or modernist. But it is not as though the other side of reform and renewal and continuity does not also bear a heavy burden in our present storm. We do not have the same epistemic burdens of discontinuity and rupture, but those of us who follow Benedict's vision do have a burden of explaining why the reception and implementation of the council has brought with it one storm after another, and whether there is any hope of pulling together the disordered threads back into a stronger, more reliable line that leads us to the Father. Can we explain all the metaphysical, doctrinal, moral, liturgical, and pastoral confusions which arose so vigorously? I think Ratzinger and then Benedict has always been at the center of this storm, which has now recently gained hurricane status. With the news constantly fixated on Rome and a church in crisis and a curia that seems incapable of addressing it, we easily forget that Benedict lives quietly at the heart of it all, in the eye of the storm, and could not be surprised by its increasing strength. If I were to choose one word right now to highlight what both Ratzinger and Benedict have tried to help us diagnose, the word would not be rupture or renewal, but relativism. Let me explain. First, the mysterium iniquitas, the mystery of iniquity, is such that all sin and ignorance, vice and disorder cannot find causal explanation. Augustine spills a great deal of ink trying to explain the cause of evil and finally arrives at the conclusion that since evil is privative by nature and not causative, it isn't rational. It doesn't relate us to the Father. It does not submit to a rational causal analysis. Only that which is good submits to causal analysis, refers us to our final end. Augustine is the one who teaches us, at least with respect to the wicked, that correlation is not causation. And yet, Augustine also teaches us that the Christian is a judge who can discern good from evil, who can trace negative correlative effects through time. And this is something I think Benedict has been doing since the 50s, diagnosing what ails the church and teaching us that while we can intellectually deal with an error in one area or another area, today we face a dictatorship of relativism that threatens to overwhelm every aspect of the church's life and thought, and threatens to, as he so frequently put it, capsize the boat. I do not think it mere coincidence that theological, moral, and liturgical abuses exploded concurrently in the 70s. There is a prehistory to all of it, if not a truly discernible order. We can sketch something quickly. After the Enlightenment, metaphysics was relativized in an immanent frame, relativized to a world of sense experience. with invisible and transcendent realities more or less inaccessible to us in Kantian terms as a standard of judgment. Absolute truth could be dialectically near us, historically unfolding in a Hegelian sense. Being itself could always be becoming in a Heideggerian sense. By mid-20th century, these categories of being and truth are unseated. For thinking about change in a new way, change now would not be thought in relationship to truth drawing things forward, or being the prior given for all change. But now change would only be thought through the category of power. This Heraclitan state of journeying, different than Christian states of journeying, was felt in theology too, nature grace disputes, which so often sought to complicate the relationship between two distinct orders, often collapsed two orders, or a move towards a range of relativistic claims in Catholic doctrine that have not borne good fruit. This touched even our greatest theologians, some who would collapse the immanent Trinity into the economic Trinity, or who would fail to safeguard the divine impassible essence. The categories were shifting in doctrinal theology, but also in moral theology. Who can dispute that a kind of relativism sprung up there, usually under the guise of proportionalism, misusing double effect distinctions to justify everything from contraception to divorce, relativistically seeking to shift certain acts as intrinsically ordered to merely finding them differently ordered. In 1983, the 1917 Code of Canon Law was replaced with a brand new code, but this one removed all the sexual crimes under which clergy could be tried in an ecclesial court. The near constant liturgical experimentation which took place in the 70s and 80s and 90s remain an embarrassment, with clown masses as the most extreme, but a range of minor changes which seemed to be at the personal relative preference of a pastor, a performance mentality that turned church into human performance rather than divine labor. Those who argue for a hermeneutic of reform and renewal and continuity have a burden of explaining all this, a burden of how so much disorder comes upon us. Our answer cannot simply be historicist. We cannot simply say 1968. Similarly, our answer cannot be a degree of causal certitude. We cannot explain evil. We cannot explain disorder, but we can attend to it. To Benedict, our age has thrown off metaphysical truth. Heidegger, being is becoming. Metaphysical truth about God was nothing other than a pre-Socratic material claim about eternal flux. But by mid-20th century, the ancient Hellenic vision of the First Academy, the Socratic, the Platonic, the Aristotelian, get reversed back into a pre-Socratic world. The Hellenic deposit that remained, if it remained, was only that of Thales, Anaximenes, Anaxagoras, Diogenes. This is what remained of the Hellenic deposit. In his Regensburg address, Benedict addresses this profound metaphysical crisis afflicting us from a different direction. He begins almost nonchalantly. In the face of such radical skepticism, it is still necessary and reasonable to raise the question of God through the use of reason. On the face of it, it wasn't controversial. On the face of it, the Regensburg address wasn't controversial because it deigned to pop the bubble of modern metaphysical skepticism, however. It was controversial because it was taken by some to name a certain irrationalism in Islam, which of course made the papers. This is ironic because what Benedict was really doing there was drawing Islamic theology closer to a voluntarist theology he associated with 14th century Catholic thought, this genealogical account, which has been laid at the feet of the 14th century since Étienne Gilson advanced it in the pre-World War II years. But the controversy was a distraction, I think, from the fundamental insight that Benedict gave us in the Regensburg lecture, which was to challenge what he had long called the de-Hellenization of Christianity, a historical way of challenging metaphysical skepticism, which had made its way even into Catholic thought from the 14th century to the present. It was his way of identifying theological errors at the root of metaphysical agnosticism, relativism, and the like. Even identifying an idol at the heart of modern thought, an idol of a capricious God who commands quite independently of what we can know about transcendent being, goodness, and truth. In some ways, his diagnosis of relativism is really a diagnosis of a fundamental, primal turn away from God, who is all good and deserving of all our love. Relativism is at the root of our turn away. You remember in Caritas in Veritate, Pope Benedict told us to critically rethink the category of relation, of how we are related, what relates us horizontally and vertically. Relativism is at root this crisis of relation. We are cut off from the Father's house as he sees us turning away from the Father through his diagnosis of de-Hellenization, which he charts in three stages. De-Hellenization first emerges, he writes, in connection with the fundamental postulates of the Reformation in the 16th century. It makes advances in the 17th and 18th centuries. He writes, metaphysics appeared as a premise derived from another source, from which faith had to be liberated in order to become once more fully itself. When Kant stated that he needed to set thinking aside in order to make room for faith, he carried this program forward with a radicalism that the reformers could never have foreseen. He thus anchored faith exclusively in practical reason, denying it access to reality as a whole. End quote. Ratzinger, the anti-Kantian. The second stage of de-Hellenization, he writes about, concerns putatively Christian thinkers such as Adolf von Harnack and Alfred Loisy. Harnack's central idea, he writes, was to return simply to the man, Jesus, and to his simple message underneath the accretions of theology and indeed the thought of Hellenization. This simple message was seen as the culmination of the religious development of humanity. Jesus was said to have put an end to worship in favor of morality, end quote. These first two stages of de-Hellenization, as Ratzinger understood them, turn us away from anything, from any true participation in that which transcends our experience, in that which rightly orders our worship, our gaze. And so any knowledge of an uncaused cause of all that exists is not knowable with any degree of certitude. God may exist, but not in any way which we can know, not in relation to any thing permanent or any one permanent who we can know about as our cause and end. This de-Hellenizing process effectively reduced reason to individual experience, to desires, to will, to some universal account of reason which never quite can punch through a closed, imminent frame. In a sense, it decouples us from rational access to truth, to God, and leaves us with nothing but our own power, including our power to determine for ourselves what is religious and moral, what our worship should be. Our standard for judging has been radically decoupled from any fixed point, and so we are left to live and move and have our being, mainly not as a thinking reed even, but as a willing reed, as one who desires, but who never desires properly the unchangeable. Benedict writes, the subject then decides on the basis of his experiences what he considers tenable in matters of religion, and the subjective conscience becomes the sole arbiter of what is ethical. In this way, though, ethics and religion lose their power to create a community and become a completely personal matter. this is a dangerous state of affairs for humanity. We are unmoored from the transcendent good, trapped in an imminent frame or lost in the cosmos, as Walker Percy put it. A third stage of de-Hellenization, Benedict argued, was currently underway. Where it begins is unclear. Somewhere after the mid-century, this third stage claims that none of the cultural conditions into which God revealed himself have any bearing on us today. It is historicist. Everything can be understood as culturally conditioned. I think it's been recently said that we didn't have a tape recorder in the first century, so we don't really know what Jesus said. Sure, Paul was opposed to homosexual activity of any kind in the first century, but just because he was opposing the pagan abuse of sexual power, and we don't really know what he meant by the word porneia, so all these cultural conditions should be wiped away. So inaccessible to us are those changeable things that we must abstract from the discarded Hellenism and get to the kernel, which can be perfectly fitted to whatever we're now reading on Vox.com. In Hong Kong, 1993, Cardinal Ratzinger said relativism was the gravest crisis of our time. In Guadalajara, in 1996, he called it the central problem of faith for our time. In 2006, at the Regensburg Address already cited, the problem is announced as the dictatorship of relativism. This is another reminder that for Ratzinger and Benedict, the idol at the heart of our modern world is the idol of relativism. He laments a dictator god. Whether he attacks Vico's stress on the truth as the maid or ventures a pre-Kantian set of errors, as he does in the Regensburg letter lecture following the Gilsonian declension narrative that begins with Scotus and Ockham so much in dispute, whether he begins with Luther's rejection of philosophy or punctures Jacques Monod's scientistic Platonism, as he does in the lectures, in the homilies, I should say, in the beginning, that scientistic Platonism, which of course, like Laplace, has no need of that hypothesis we call God. Whether he draws the narrative forward or backwards, whether he draws his lines boldly or subtly, the lines for Ratzinger and Benedict alike are always pointing in one direction, that relativism, the wrong understanding of the category of relation, is the root of a civilizational crisis. And this burrows deep into Professor Ruddy's paper about the true meaning of orthodoxy, worship rightly ordered. It's tempting to stop there, to say, well, that's Benedict's metaphysical argument and it doesn't connect to any of his other arguments. But the same argument does recur in other categories, most notably the metaphysical agnosticism and relativism, and has devastating effects on liturgical reform. He writes about those liturgical theologians who took great liberties with the direction of the Council Fathers at Vatican II. He laments, quote, "the fact that the liturgy was presented as a new structure set up against what had been formed in the course of history and was now being prohibited, and that the liturgy was made to appear in some ways no longer as a living process but as a product of specialized knowledge and juridical competence, has brought with it some extremely serious damages for us, indeed." And further, he writes, "in this way, in fact, the impression has arisen that the liturgy is made by us. That is, not something that exists prior to us, something given, but that it depends on our decisions. It follows as a consequence that this decision-making capacity is not recognized only in specialists or in a central authority, but that in the final analysis, each community wants to give itself its own liturgy." Yikes. He continues, "but when the liturgy is something each one makes by himself, then it no longer gives us what is its true quality. Encounter with the mystery, which is not our product, but our origin and the wellspring of life," end quote. The dictatorship of relativism delights in liturgical historicism, liturgical rupture, innovation, private judgment, creative fidelity. And in the liturgy as a kind of human performance rather than a solemn work of God that transports us mystically to Calvary, instead we turn towards one another in positivistic, horizontal ways to pass that peace that we have made. Perhaps he draws the correlation I am after most forcefully when he simply states, quote, very famously states, the ecclesial crisis in which we find ourselves today depends in great part on the collapse of the liturgy. As CDF prefect Gratzinger wrote in Dominus Iesus 16, the church is not something that invents itself from below, but this is precisely what he thinks has gone awry. In 1985, Ratzinger insisted in an interview, we must be far more resolute than heretofore in opposing rationalistic relativism, confusing claptrap, and pastoral infantilism. Whew. These things degrade the liturgy. In this issue of Nova et Vetra, which was so beautifully edited by our own Father Stephen Fields, which he held up, Cardinal Avery Dulles wrote that Ratzinger saw liturgical relativism at the heart of the crisis because, quote, liturgy presupposes that the heavens have been opened up and that God is coming to his people. The liturgy, therefore, must be the action of Christ in the church, a sacred rite of the whole Christ in which the congregation is primarily receptive, end quote. Ratzinger sees that liturgical relativism is also a problem reducing the Mass, a liturgical positivism reducing the Mass in such a way that it becomes our invention. And if it's our invention, it is no cure for us. Ratzinger writes, the decisive factor, therefore, is the primacy of Christology. The liturgy is God's work, or it does not exist at all. Since the priest represents this first of Christ, he refers each gathering to a point beyond itself into the whole, end quote. Cardinal Dulles concurs, Ratzinger's interpretation of the liturgy, he writes, is at opposite poles from a modern relativistic individualism, which so degrades us. Rooted in negative liberty, we can also see the effects of this on moral thinking. Moral relativism marks a flight from truth and separates freedom from truth, a dominant theme in Ratzinger's moral thought. In one place, Ratzinger points to Sartre. For Sartre, he says, there is no truth. Freedom is without direction or measure, yet this complete absence of truth, the complete absence of any kind of moral or metaphysical restraint, the absolute anarchical freedom of man constituted by his self-determination is revealed for anyone who tries to live it out, not as the most sublime exaltation of existence, but as a life of nothingness, as absolute emptiness, as the definition of damnation. The anarchistic freedom, taken to a radical conclusion, does not redeem man. It makes him into a faulty creation, living without meaning, end quote, from Truth and Tolerance. The application of principles to changing circumstances is perhaps one way of describing what John the 23rd was after in calling a council. New ways of communicating the ancient faith were needed. What we got were new and deep fights. Benedict's competing hermeneutics shows us, I think, a difference between those who judge everything in terms of power versus those who judge things according to their proper relation to truth, both natural and revealed. The Holy Father has said clericalism is at the root of our present crisis, and I think there's a way that Holy Father Benedict could also agree that this, insofar as we understand clericalism as reducing the cleric to an agent of power rather than an agent of truth to be revealed, a witness who bears testimony. As Benedict put it, the virtual council has often seemed more powerful than the actual council. And there is a reason for this. The virtual council does not trade on truth, but on power. It can only secure itself by way of power. Not so with the actual council. As St. Augustine says about truth, it doesn't need a defense. It just roars on its own. I want to suggest that everything about the Benedict papacy, including his resignation, his abdication, dramatizes the contrast between these two hermeneutics, one which has wrought devastation and one which hopes in the Lord. One which works through utter obedience and fidelity to the true eternal principles and propositions revealed to us in the sacred deposit of Christ entrusted to his apostles, and one which works only on a standard for change that is constantly receding from our view and making us ever more unstable and distant from the Lord who is in the boat. The metaphysical, theological, liturgical, and moral storms are part of a life-threatening weather system which seems only to gather strength by the day. But there is this other image that Benedict gives us. Indeed, he is very fond of it. I think it is an image that he carries with him into his the silence, enclosure of his new form of Petrine ministry. He cites the image many times, but never more prominently than in his last general audience. It's the image of Jesus Christ with his disciples in a boat during a storm. Just before his resignation, he says, quote, "I felt like St. Peter with the apostles in the boat on the Sea of Galilee. The Lord has given us so many days of sun and of light winds, days when the catch was abundant. There were also moments when the waters were rough and the winds against us, as throughout the church's history, and the Lord seemed to be sleeping. But I have always known that the Lord is in that boat, and I have always known that the bark of the church is not mine, but his." He also anticipates the objection that he has retreated from the cross, or if you prefer, the storm. Rather, he says he is entering into it more deeply, into the eye of the storm. He writes, "My decision to resign the active exercise of the ministry does not revoke this. I do not return to private life, to a life of travel, meetings, receptions, conferences, and so on. I am not abandoning the cross, but remaining in a new way at the side of the crucified Lord. I no longer bear the power of office for the governance of the church, but in the service of prayer I remain, so to speak, in the enclosure of St. Peter. St. Benedict, whose name I bear as Pope, will be a great example for me in this. He showed us the way for a life which, whether active or passive, is completely given over to the work of God." End quote. Last summer, on July 15th, 2017, following the now infamous Dubia, cardinals had posed to the Pope concerning some confusing passages in Amoris Laetitia. Benedict XVI sent a message to be read aloud at the funeral of Cardinal Joachim Meissner. In that message, the Pope Emeritus said that the church is a boat on the verge of capsizing. The Pope Emeritus said that he was moved by Cardinal Meissner's ability to live out a deep conviction that the Lord does not abandon his church, even when the boat has taken on so much water that it appears to be on the verge of capsizing. The key to the image, of course, is not the boat or the waters which threaten it, but Christ. Christ, the hope of our salvation. Spes salve. From the eye of the storm, Benedict wants to lead us into the heart of reality, to which all things are related. By entering into the Petrine ministry in a different mode, he is still teaching us that there is no positivistic solution for our crisis. There is no fix There is no tweak that we can make here to seminary formation. There is no tweak here that we can make to this or that or the other thing. There is no positivistic solution that comes from us that has not been given prior to us. Our current crisis has been inflamed by old abuse cases brought forward, but also by a rage that runs even deeper, which runs right into what I was reminded of yesterday, Vatican I called the motives of credibility, the faith and holiness of the church in the dock. The testimony which alleges so many bishops involved in covering up for one another hits a fundamental anxiety, not only that some clergy live double lives, but that our fathers lie to us. It is a crisis of the Father who we have fled from. If the Father lies, is he a father? An anxiety deep within us. The moral panic that many of the faithful feel is due to a fundamental anxiety that the faith itself has been relativized by successors of the apostles, some of whom have behaved in ways that seem to suggest that they neither believe in nor fear the just judgments of God. Indeed, they feel that for all the recent the faithful who are angry feel that for all the recent emphasis on accompaniment and being pastoral, what we really fear is a church without fathers, a church abandoned. Ratzinger and Benedict were concerned with this fundamental loss of the Father, this fundamental break in the right category of relation, which brings us into the communion of love. We can see it in his writing on metaphysics, creation, liturgy, morality, as well as the church's social and political witness. In every case, we see that the crisis we face is fundamentally a privative one, which takes us away from the good, the true, from nature, from our God, the Father in heaven. I think this also puts us in a position to see that the effects of a certain pastoral relativism have been made visible by our crisis too. The bishop as corporate manager has almost entirely obscured a vision of the bishop as a father who tells us the truth in order to set us free. As a father, it hits me deeply. Here we can confess that bishops are fathers who have sometimes not acted like fathers. The clerical abuse scandal, as we are now calling it, is filled with the typical sins associated with money, sex, and power. The church has seen them in the clergy before. This is not new. The scale is new. The cover-up is exquisite in its wickedness. We should not despair, however, of God's help. This is the point. We should not despair of God's help. We should despair of our own help, of our own solutions, but we should not despair of God's help. We should not despair. To combat our crisis, we must not only expose the truth about clerical sins of money, sex, and power, but we must also insist that holiness is possible, that chastity is possible. Not only is it possible, but that it has rewards that are 100-fold. God does not command the impossible. We must combat our crisis with a renewed sense that our obedience is owed to bishops only insofar as they are in the boat with the Lord. Benedict knew we were in a storm. He knew it better than we did. He had ideas about how to stop various relativistic flights from reason, nature, truth, beauty, goodness, holiness. But the combination of so many flights away from the Father has overwhelmed us. When Benedict resigned, I must confess that it made me feel like a son abandoned. He tapped into this anxiety of being left without a father. But as the scandal has unfolded in recent days, I've increasingly felt that Benedict has shown us a way through the storm by clinging to Christ. In his last general audience, he said that he was not abandoning us, He was not abandoning the cross of the papacy, but entering more deeply into the mystery of the Petrine ministry. As I've reflected on this, I've come to think that he was teaching us something essential. The Petrine ministry is not a political project. It is not the chief executive of a large multinational organization. It is not celebrity. It is not the Daily Angelus or the in-flight papal interview, nor is it even encyclicals, nor especially is it World Youth Days. The Petrine ministry is a spiritual reality which unites the whole church in union with Christ. That is the truth, I tell you as a father. It is supernatural. It is sacramental, not political. It is true spiritual paternity on earth. Our crisis is rooted not only in the dictatorship of relativism, but also in the sense that we are looking for fathers that we do not see. Benedict's last encyclical is wordless. It is the word of a father to his children in danger. Run to Christ, our only hope, who reveals to us the Father and who with the Holy Spirit is the truth, who alone can purify and free the church from her present suffering. Thank you.
We now have time for some brief remarks from Father Fields in response, and then some questions, hopefully.
As a brief response to this first section of our conference on Benedict's systematic theology, I would like to draw on the 13 articles of the Festschrift to ask this question: how does Benedict's mind work? What qualities define Benedict as a systematic theological thinker? And I've outlined three. The first one is this: Benedict is a dialectical thinker whose syntheses embody creative tension. This can be seen in his ecclesiology. At the time he served as a paritus at Vatican II, for instance, he favored the image of the people of God over the mystical body of Christ, which had assumed center stage in Pius XII's groundbreaking encyclical Mystici Corporis Christi of 1943. But as Benedict's thought developed in subsequent years, he came to stress the notion of sacrament of communion because he saw it as embracing the essence of the other models and images. A sacrament is an outward sign of an inward reality. Hence, the same reality, that is, the resurrected Christ living at the Father's right hand, is really and efficaciously present in all models and images of the Church. Then, too, Benedict is known for wishing to preserve the integrity of individual bishops to teach, govern, and sanctify within their own dioceses, over against, for instance, what could be seen as the intrusive incursions of national episcopal conferences. And yet, on the other hand, Benedict does assign a clear priority to the universal church over the local community, because it is the faith of the church qua church that, apostolically received as one holy and Catholic, is instantiated within the local communities. Number one, that is, Benedict as a dialectical thinker, can be seen also in his ecclesiology. Take, for instance, his understanding of the so-called intermediate state of the soul, that state in which the soul continues to exist after death and yet before the resurrection of the body. Benedict's own position seeks a synthesis between those, like Karl Rahner, who deny the intermediate state altogether because they assert an immediate resurrection of the body after death, and those, like Aquinas, who assert the soul to be a substantial form capable of its own qualified perdurance after death while awaiting the body's resurrection. Benedict affirms both the intermediate state and yet he dispenses with soul as form, so that what perdures after death but before resurrection is the person's relationality in love to God and other human persons. The human person is, then, for Benedict, essentially not a separable soul, but a being constituted by God for dialogue with him. And this relationality is what perdures. The second quality of Benedict as a thinker is that he is a critical thinker who engages the tradition precisely in order to advance and develop it. This can be seen in his famous conciliar hermeneutics, often, as Professor Pecknold was saying, called the hermeneutics of continuity. It posits that the teachings of Vatican II, and indeed of all ecumenical councils of the Church, represent a renewal indeed, but a renewal of the one Church, which preserves its essence, which is the one apostolic deposit of faith that is guaranteed by the one Spirit of truth. Now, in putting forth this hermeneutics, Benedict is heavily indebted to John Henry Newman's magisterial work on doctrinal development that accounts for the paradox of continuity in what can appear as decided discontinuity. And furthermore, Benedict is also indebted to the theology of his own 19th century German compatriot, Johann Adam Mohler, who sees the doctrines of the Church as verbal expressions of something far deeper and far greater than their own words, the very inner reality of Christ's ongoing incarnation, which, through the Spirit, is the Church's core reality. This second quality of Benedict's mind, namely, that he is a critical thinker engaging the tradition to develop it, can also be seen in his first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, in which he develops the nuance and mutual relation between justice and charity. He develops this by delving deep into the eschatology of St. John's Gospel, also into St. Augustine's understanding of original sin, and also into Thomas Aquinas' treatment of the virtues. And he does this resourcing of the tradition in order to fuse together his own creative synthesis. Number two, that is, Benedict as a creative thinker, can also be seen, critical and creative thinker, can also be seen in his work on the spirit of the liturgy, in which he underscores two elements essential to Christian worship. The first is its embodiment of Sabbath. This means that just as in Genesis, the Sabbath is the day of rest after God's labor of creating, so for the Christian, worship ought to entail a Sabbath dimension. It ought to foreshadow the goal at the end of life's creative labors. This goal is to rest with God, which rest is nothing less than our divinization in grace. The second element, as Professor Ruddy mentioned, is the embodiment in Christian worship of sacrifice. Benedict sees all replacement cults of sacrifice as done away with in the Eucharist. In other words, no animal or object is offered to God in place of the human person so that we might be reconciled to God, as in the rites of the Jewish temple. Quite the contrary, because the incarnation subsumes all of us into itself, Christ's unique sacrifice encompasses us completely so that in the Eucharist we might be offered eternally to God. Now, in developing Sabbath and sacrifice as essential to liturgy, Benedict draws richly on St. Augustine's 4th century exegesis of the Psalms. As to Sabbath, for instance, Augustine refers to Psalm 37 that says, "Those who remember the Sabbath and run toward the bridegroom," that is, allegorically Christ, "breathe in the fragrance of his anointed self." And as to sacrifice, Augustine refers to Psalm 50, where David, in seeking the futility of animal offerings, prefigures the one true sacrifice of Christ. Thirdly, Benedict is a surprising thinker whose conclusions can defy facile liberal conservative oppositions. This can be seen in his third encyclical, Caritas in Veritate, where, it has been argued, he favors communio school commentators like David Schindler over more conservative Thomists like John Courtney Murray on the question of whether Christian revelation remains neutral about democratic capitalism. In this encyclical, Benedict contends that because economic activity concerns integral human development, it cannot be separated from the Christian view of the person. It therefore seems to follow that economic activity is not autonomous, but subject to critique by gospel principles. We might wonder, as a result, whether Benedict has not set up, perhaps troublingly, some momentum toward a Christian theocracy. And indeed, this surprise is buttressed by Benedict's frank admission in his book Values in a Time of Upheaval that the theory of evolution has compromised the church's ability to appeal to the natural law as the foundation of morality. Intriguing and highly illuminating remarks on this very question await us in Professor Kevin Doak's presentation. Quality number three, that is, Benedict as a surprising thinker, can also be seen in the engagingly original ways in which Benedict frames important truths about Christianity. In his introduction to Christianity, Benedict endeavors to define in several dimensions the very essence of our faith, the very essence of the Christian revelation. What, in other words, distinctly constitutes it? Among these dimensions is what he calls, again, surprisingly, intriguingly, the law of disguise. This means, for him, that God manifests himself as, and here he quotes Luther's Latin expression, sub contrario. This means that although God is the Alpha and the Omega of all, yet this infinite, most perfect Lord of history makes himself manifest in what is his exact opposite, a condemned, scourged, spat upon, crucified person in whom God is simply unrecognizable. Hans Urs von Balthasar, the 20th century Swiss theologian, has spoken himself about this law of disguise as the apparent ugliness of God. But, says Benedict, again, taking us by surprise, only the God who is perfectly and precisely Alpha and Omega could so disguise himself as totally other that in doing so he would show us that he is indeed the absolute other than which nothing greater can be conceived. Ironically, paradoxically, surprisingly, then, God's bizarre, even monstrous disguise, not only reveals his sublime beauty, but his integrity precisely as God. In sum, then, how does Benedict's ingenious mind work? It is marked by dialectical syntheses. It is marked by creative engagement with the tradition in order to advance it. And it contains surprising insights that defy facile ideology.
Thank you very much. I think we have time just for a few questions. Yes.
So how do we interpret perhaps Benedict's theology of the liturgy and ecclesiology with increased diversity of the liturgy with things like the Anglican Ordinariate and the sort of restoration of the extraordinary form to being something a little bit less extraordinary?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing to say about that is that, of course, it's true that the Latin Rite is only one rite. It's the majority rite. I think one of the things that strikes me about Summorum Pontificum is the way in which he thinks about a cross-fertilization, which is ordering us to the same reality that's been given. And so that's what I would say about the recognition of other rites in the Church is it doesn't need to be understood in a liturgically relativist way. I think some people do read it and use that way. I've actually heard some people suggest just that if we have all these different rites, then we can make up our own rite. It's no big deal. But I think Summorum Pontificum gives us a kind of logic for that, that it's these are all part of the same liturgy, as it were, the cosmic heavenly liturgy. They're ordered to that. And if they aren't ordered to that, we don't see them as ordered to the heavenly liturgy. The Greeks have a kind of regular reminder of this. We have it too in the Latin Rite, but it's good to keep in mind that all the rites are reflections of a heavenly liturgy.
Yes?
So you talked about kind of we're at this point of de-Hellenization. And I'm interested in your thoughts on establishing, I guess, a re-Hellenization of society in terms of rite worship and liturgy, and especially as where we have this emphasis on liturgy, how that has an impact on man as a political creature within the polis itself.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a big question you're asking. I mean, in a sense, I think this is part of our social and political crisis too. This is, when I talked about the crisis of fatherhood, really, of spiritual paternity in the Church, but look, we live in a world that's also in a crisis of paternity. Marriages, you know, there's the men don't want to get married, be fathers. And I think this is part of a decoupling from metaphysical realities, that we're decoupled from nature, we're decoupled from ourselves, we're decoupled from what's been given to us, and decoupled then from the sense that we have a duty to give, right, to be this pro-existence idea. With political unrest right now, I think we feel this very deeply that we're unmoored. We're unmoored from the Constitution. We're unmoored in our democratic sensibilities. The demos does not have any realities to which it is rooted or pointed. It's just kind of a restlessness without end and without origin. And so if you want to think very carefully about how this plays out in social political realities, there is a profound need for a metaphysical realism. And it doesn't mean that you need to create a theocracy or jettison democracy or constitutions or even rights, but you need to rethink the category of relation to categories of being, right? That's what you need.
please join me in thanking our three excellent speakers.